listening to Real Talk Radio with Nicole Antoinette, episode 39. Welcome to Real Talk Radio with Nicole Antoinette. That's me, the podcast that's filled with refreshingly honest conversations about the wonderful mess of being human. So if you are new to this little corner of the podcast space, then hi, welcome. If you're not new, then hi also, and welcome back. But if you are new, let me tell you what it is that we do here. More than anything, we have honest conversations. Real Talk Radio kind of is exactly what it sounds like. And as your host, it's such an honor and such a pleasure to sit down with a huge range of people. I talk to athletes, writers, entrepreneurs. I talk to parents, coaches of different kinds, world travelers, self-proclaimed adventurers, artists, and more. But no matter who I'm talking to, the mission is the same: to go deep on all the behind the scenes stuff that I just feel isn't talked about enough. Everything from fears and struggles to true daily routines, guilty pleasures, self-care practices that actually work, regrets, emotional healing, the process of making changes in your life, changing habits, that sort of thing, relationships, and more. Each conversation is different, obviously, and brings up different topics and different raw truths. But my hope is that listening to this show just makes you laugh, think, and feel less alone, which honestly is all that I ever want, is to know that I'm not alone in whatever it is that I'm feeling, thinking, worrying about, experiencing, all of that. And so with that in mind, and in honor of my commitment to Real Talk and to being honest, I actually want to take a moment here in season 5 to share my vision for the future of Real Talk Radio with you. It feels actually a bit scary to be saying this out loud, because what I want to build isn't really the norm for podcasts, but I'm going to share it anyway. So ready? Here goes. It's been so much fun to partner up with a few of my favorite brands for sponsorship the past few seasons, but if I'm being really, really super duper honest, my true vision for the future of this show actually doesn't include sponsors. I know that's a bit radical in the podcast world, where almost every show has multiple sponsors and ads, and if that works for them, I think that's awesome. But my true vision is a little bit different, and I want to, you know, move in alignment with that. Because my vision and my dream is for Real Talk Radio to be 100% community supported. I want this to be more than a podcast. I want it to be a family, a fun, quirky, delightfully imperfect and messy family, just like any other family, that's filled with real people who come together to talk about things and support each other and who are committed to this Real Talk revolution. To be honest, I don't know if this vision for a 100% community-supported show will work. I don't know if it's possible, but I'm willing to take the risk and experiment. So here's how we're going to do that. I've created a community for us using Patreon, which allows you to make a pledge of just $8 or more, of course, if you choose, per 8-episode season. So not only will your support keep the show going with a new season released every other month of 2016, but you'll also get exclusive bonus content during the in-between months. So that's the months between each season of the show. This bonus content includes personalized Q&As, where I'll answer any question that's on your mind. Really, kind of nothing's off limits, as you probably know by now. The bonus content includes exclusive long-form conversations and interviews with wonderful guests that aren't aired publicly, so basically bonus episodes of the show. It even includes access to the Squad Pod, which is a shorter version of Real Talk Radio where the guests are, well, you, the members of the community. Everyone who supports the show with a pledge of $8 or more has the chance to be a guest on the Behind the Scenes podcast, which will air exclusively to the community. So it's an incredible way for us to really get to know each other and to start to form our powerful little family. And I'm honestly just so excited about the months ahead and the chance to get to know you for real through this new way of doing things. As of right now, you'll find over 20 hours of bonus content that's available in our little community, and you can get immediate access to that content, and you can join our family by going to patreon.com/Nicole Antoinette. to make your pledge. So that's patreon.com/Nicole Antoinette. It's super easy, and I know that you'll love having access to fresh new bonus content every other month. And honestly, wouldn't it be cool to prove that our little Real Talk revolution doesn't need outside sponsorship or approval in order to gain momentum? There's something about that idea that I really love, and I appreciate you so much for being part of this with me and for giving this experiment a try to build this vision. So that gives you a peek at what I am hoping will come from the future of the show, but now it's time to dive into today's episode. As you know, in each episode, I bring you an in-depth conversation with a new guest, and in today's episode, you'll get to meet Kathleen Shannon. Kathleen is the co-founder of Braid Creative, a personal branding agency for creative entrepreneurs who blend work and life, like designers, writers, artists, foodies, yogis, and lifestyle professionals. Kathleen also co-hosts the Being Boss podcast for creative entrepreneurs, where she shares weekly interviews, insights, and candid conversations on what it takes to be boss, from mindset to habits to blending who you are with what you do. In this episode, Kathleen and I get right to the heart of some wonderfully weighty topics, such as the deeply personal decision of whether or not to have children, in which she and I have chosen different paths. We talk about how to deal with fear, the fine line between beneficial growth and self-help addiction. We talk about where we both are in our spiritual journeys, the struggle of trying to be authentic online, the unanswerable questions of life, and so much more. This episode is truly Real Talk Radio at its finest because Kathleen opens up fully and honestly with no agenda and shares who she is, what she believes, and what she's going through right now in her real life in real time. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. All of that starts in just a moment, and as always, you'll be able to find the links and resources mentioned in this episode over in the show notes at NicoleAntoinette.com/podcast. Spectacular. We are good to go. Kathleen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And today, the time of this recording, today is your birthday. So happy birthday.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for spending your birthday with me. This is such a treat.
It's a fun way to spend a birthday.
How else are you celebrating? Are you a big birthday person? Is that something that's important to you?
Yes and no. It's so weird because growing up, I mean, yeah, like for my whole family, I'm like one of those, it's my birthday week, it's my birthday month kind of thing. But as I've gotten older, and especially since having a kid, like I just had my last birthday. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like a normal day, but my normal days are pretty dreamy. I had breakfast with my husband and my son, Fox, who is two. We went to one of our favorite breakfast spots here. I had some cronuts. Do you know what that is?
I do know the kind of cross between a donut and a croissant, right?
Yeah, it's okay. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, so it sounds pretty amazing.
And I had some apple fritter and some coffee and some eggs and smoked salmon. And it's pretty delicious. Pretty delicious morning so far. Then I had a workout. And then I treated myself to, do you know what like Lush Cosmetics is?
Absolutely. Yeah, they make really wonderful vegan stuff. So I'm vegan, yes. And that is of interest to me. So yeah.
Yeah, so I treated myself to a few Lush things. Though I was disappointed to see, I like this rose toner spray that they have, that there is parabens in it, which, I mean, I don't know, maybe you and I could geek out on beauty products. I don't know how into that you are, but I was surprised. That they have some like not so great things in their products. Anyway, that aside, I treated myself to some Lush, and I'm not really like a super stickler for that kind of stuff. And I treated myself to some lipstick at Sephora. So anyway, it's been, and then now I'm talking to you, which is like, whenever I think about my dream day, and I think why I've created my career the way I've created it, part of it is just having conversations with other creative people who are trying to live and work the life that they love. So here we are.
Here we are. I know. I totally agree. So back to the cosmetics. Yes, let's talk about this. So
okay.
I'm not a super, this has actually come up on another episode this season, which is funny, about makeup and other things. I'm not a very girly girl in that way. Not to say I don't love stuff. I just never really got into a good routine. And it's funny, I turned 30 last year and I had my kind of wake up call of, oh, maybe you should take better care of your skin, or maybe you should, right? So I started looking into stuff. And a couple years ago, in my quest for, you know, minimalizing my life and simplifying things, went through a phase of trying to make all of my own stuff, right? Like the shampoo that's baking soda and whatever, and do like all the DIY stuff, and you like wash your face with, I don't know, honey or whatever. And I was like, basically just like rubbing food all over myself. I don't know that this is the best. Oh man. But yeah, so you use Lush stuff. What do you love? Do you have like a routine or any product that you're just completely into?
Oh, man. Well, okay, so caveat here, because I talked about, you know, kind of using organic products or, like, non-toxic products. I put so much toxic shit on my face all the time. So, and I even recently, I haven't even shared this anywhere except on Periscope, I recently even got Botox. So it's not even, like, and we can talk more about that, but it's not even something where I'm, like, a super stickler. But in general, I try and be pretty conscious or aware of what I'm doing and always just trying to take steps to be better. So my basic routine is I've always been really fortunate and blessed with pretty clear skin. I never washed my face as a teenager. Like, it just never even crossed my mind. And up until recently, I never really did until I started wearing makeup. And so I have to wear like waterproof eyeliner and waterproof mascara because my eyes are kind of hooded and my eyelashes touch the skin like right below my eyebrows. And so anything I'm wearing always rubs off up on my upper eyelid. Anyway, all that to say, like, I wear some pretty durable makeup. And so what I love to use to wash my makeup off is an olive oil cleanser. And I use some stuff, like, I don't make my own, and I know that you can do that, but I have some stuff from a company called DHC, and you can get it off of Amazon. That's how I get it. It's this oil cleanser. And then I follow that up with a Lush scrub. I think it's called Dark Angels, but it's like a charcoal cleanser and it's gritty. So it feels like you're really getting in there. I know like some people who are, do face things for a living, like they're mortified thinking about like I'm scrubbing my face with things, but it feels good. And so that's pretty much it. I use some like lotion in the morning. I use a brand called Michelle, and that's from Whole Foods. And that's like a pretty clean, non-toxic brand. And then I wear a ton of makeup. So, I mean, not every day, but like my dream job, aside from doing what I do, is being a makeup artist.
Oh, interesting. That's so funny. I would be the least qualified person ever to do that job. But I recently, a couple of weeks ago, I went and got a facial, which was probably the first time that I've done that in a decade maybe. And, you know, this is on my quest to be a grown up and to take care of my skin. And, you know, she was like, your skin is so dry. It feels like sandpaper. And so it's like, I live in Bend, Oregon, and have been here for about a year and a half. And I always forget that it's high desert. Like, it's so dry here. And I've never lived somewhere that's, I guess, this dry. And apparently my skin is noticing. And, you know, so she did all these things. And it was insane how much better my skin was afterwards. It's like I was never really convinced that facials would make a big difference if I had the money to spend on something that felt kind of self-indulgent body work. You know, it would always be massage because I love getting massages. And after this facial for the next, I don't know, 2 weeks, my skin was, I was like, what is this? Like, whose baby face is this face? So I think, whoa, I'm a convert now. It was insane.
I've never had a facial.
Well, I would have never recommended it until now. And now I'm thinking, okay, well, when can I get another one? And she gave me samples of all the things she uses. And they're all, you know, super organic, this, you know, amazing.
Yeah.
This peel, I mean, peels. This is not something that was ever part of my life. And now I'm, you know, once a week in the bathroom using a little facial peel. But it's also, I don't know, it's kind of nice because I'm like you, like I never really washed my face. I never really did any of that. And I'm slowly starting to turn it into, you know, 5 to 10 minutes in the evening of just like a nice little self-care break or taking care of myself. And it's funny how just 5 to 10 minutes of, hey, you're worth washing your face, which maybe sounds silly, yes, but it's been pretty impactful for me.
That's really cool. I love that. I recently had my eyebrows waxed, also trying to be an adult because I've never done that before. And I went into a woman who does facials, like that's probably her primary expertise, at a really nice spa. It's totally legit. And so I go in to get my eyebrows waxed and she was like, one, you don't need your eyebrows waxed. And I was like, okay, what about a facial? Like, just tell me what's wrong with me. Like, what do I need to do to fix myself? And she was like, your skin is perfect. Like, go home. So I was like, well, okay.
Okay, right. Bye. Oh,
bye, see ya.
That's hilarious. Okay, so while we're on the like style, beauty, whatever topic, I remember last time we talked, you mentioned that, I don't know how recently, but it sounded like pretty recently, you had drastically cut your hair. So I want to hear more about that.
Yeah, so I had locks down to my waist, long platinum blonde locks, and I had had those for about 3 years. And I had never felt more like myself than whenever I locked my hair up. It was a super easy process, but not one that I would recommend to everyone. And then after a while, they just got really heavy, and especially swimming, they were like sponges in water. And so I would say every morning I wake up and I ask myself, what can I do today to feel more like myself, or to feel more like the person I want to become? And I one day woke up, and actually it wasn't just one day. I had started to think about it for a while, and people started emailing me asking me about the cultural appropriation of my hair. And there were just some deep, hard conversations, but then also some like really superficial stuff around my hairstyle. And so I decided to cut all my locks off. So now I have really short hair. It's kind of like undercut on the sides, so shaved on the sides and then a little bit longer on top. It's still platinum blonde. And I totally feel more like myself now that I have my hair cut too. So I think it just speaks to the adaptability of human beings. And I think it's really easy to attach our identity to certain things that are attached to how we look or how we present ourselves. And just knowing that, like, we're adaptable, we can change. And for me, it's funny, like, I had a friend, actually a pen pal, recently point out to me that I try and find meaning in everything. So, of course, with cutting my hair, I'm trying to find meaning in it. But at the same time, it's just a different haircut. So it's both. It's both things.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with so much of what you said. I mean, that's a huge change, waist-long dreadlocks, right? To basically, yeah, like, shaved on the side, super short hair. So that's a huge change. I think it's interesting, though, what you were saying about essentially getting feedback, probably positive, negative questions, whatever, from people just based on your hair, right? Like, that's, I don't know, like, it seems strange to me. Like, go away, it's my hair, it's none of your business.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? I don't know that it's none of your business, because I do feel like how I present myself is a statement. And it's a statement that I've been making my whole life with how I dress and what I look like. And so in some ways, it is part of their business. And most people are just really curious. And so that's great. Like, if that's a conversation starter, awesome. But good feedback, negative feedback, no matter what anyone thinks about me, it's none of my business. And I know that whenever I started feeling defensive about some questions, that it meant that I needed to dig a little bit deeper. So, like, I don't really want to get into a conversation of, like, cultural appropriation of locks, or even now after Beyoncé's formation, a lot of people are wearing their hair in cornrows now. And for me personally, like, I think it's really a cool thing to celebrate other cultures, but I'm saying that as a girl with a ton of white privilege. So, you know what I mean? Like, I don't even know what I don't know. So that's why I don't really feel like I can, like, carefully articulate why I felt okay with having dreadlocks, because maybe it's not okay having dreadlocks. And anyway, so it is something that I started thinking about but I wouldn't judge another white girl for having dreadlocks. I wouldn't be like, oh, that's culturally inappropriate, because it's not really my place.
Interesting. Comment on it. I love everything you're saying. I mean, this idea that, you know, how we are presenting ourselves physically is a statement, whether we're making that choice intentionally or not, right? Like, that it is some kind of a statement. And this came up for me kind of during that same period of time when I was, I don't know, like, washing my hair with baking soda, whatever we want to call that phase, like, the body covered in food phase. You know, I've always been very into kind of minimalism and simplicity. And, you know, If my husband shared kind of these same tendencies, I would be like, yeah, let's, like, live in a van and travel around and own, like, three things. Like, that there's something in me that would very much want that. And I think that there was a good period of time where I judged people and even the desire in myself to spend money or time on what seemed like trivial beauty or aesthetic related things. And, you know, that was a really interesting thing for me to have to dig deeper and dig into, that it's somehow, you know, quote, better, spiritually better, whatever, to not care, right? To be above that type of thing. And I like really dug into that a lot and kind of came away feeling that quite the opposite is actually true, that not only is it fine to care about that kind of stuff, but that it is, it's a statement. And I love that question that you said about waking up in the morning and asking, what can I do today to feel more like me? And I think that this plays a big role, like our personal style and our, you know, kind of self-care in that way and self-expression is important, and that we're allowed to do that. And it was, might sound like a small thing, but that was a really big shift for me to give myself permission to care about what I look like.
Totally. I love it. And I love using who we are as an art form and as an expression of creativity, whether that's what we're wearing. I mean, sometimes I wake up in the morning, like right now, for example, I'm not wearing any makeup, and that makes me feel most like myself. But does that mean that, you know, tomorrow I might feel more like myself wearing red lipstick, you know, whatever it is. So, I think it's just like a personal decision. So I recently had a conversation on another podcast about, showing up as your most authentic self. And I would say like that kind, the authenticity is definitely one of my highest core values. And the woman I was talking to, her name is Marley. She was like, don't you think it's more authentic? Like, don't you think a homeless person on the street is actually showing their most raw self versus someone like David Bowie, who's always wearing like a costume or a facade or makeup? And I was like, man, absolutely not. Like for me, watching David Bowie perform in all of his different iterations is so spiritual and so magical that he can show me on the outside what's going on the inside for him. That is creativity. And I was like, and you know, to the point of, is the homeless person the most rawest expression of who they are? I don't think so. I don't think that a homeless person who is struggling wakes up in the morning saying, yes, this is my most authentic self. I mean, I sincerely doubt it.
Yeah. I mean, but I also think that speaks to something that's really interesting to me about this concept of authenticity. One of the, it's definitely whatever word we want to use, authenticity, honesty, anything in that space is obviously really important to me too. And I have to catch myself at times when the kind of some of the public definitions of or the cultural definitions of authenticity start to feel like a cage or like a trap to me. And I notice that that's always when we assume that someone's authentic self is only one way, right? Like I love what you spoke to about today. What makes me feel most like me is not wearing makeup. Tomorrow it might be wearing red lipstick. And obviously we're using, you know, kind of like outward right. manifestations, but like that's, it's the same way. I think about this anytime I have a conversation with someone about like finding your voice, right? Or get, you know, whether that's mm-hmm. it through writing or through whatever, that, you know, the conversation that I would have with my best friend would probably be different in terms of content and language than, you know, a wonderful conversation that I would have with my mother-in-law. It doesn't mean mm-hmm. that either of those are inauthentic or that they aren't me, but I think sometimes in this kind of quest for authenticity, we sometimes forget that we're really complicated, nuanced people, right?
100%. And I think that's the fun part about the quest for authenticity is that it's always changing and evolving. Your boundaries are going to change and evolve. Your interests. I mean, we're people who are changing. And so, yeah.
Well, I mean, and actually, this is something that I think would be interesting to dig into given your work, right, with branding and everything and helping people in this space. So first, you know, maybe you can kind of give an overview of the work that you do. And then I'd love to talk about this a little bit in terms of like how we can have a strong brand while still giving ourselves the freedom to grow and change.
Yeah, it's such an interesting question and one that I'm, you know, always digging into, especially with my work. So I own Braid Creative and Consulting with my sister, Tara, and we really focus on personal branding for creative entrepreneurs. So we're not only helping them get their positioning and their messaging on paper, we're helping them with their logo and graphic design, but it's a really collaborative process where everything that we're uncovering about these people that we're working with is, you know, really trying to figure out like what doesn't change. Even as your interests change, like what kind of is that golden thread that weaves through everything that you do that kind of stays the same? So we're really trying to capture that essence in the work that we do. And so for me, I mean, I can just speak to my experience because I know that the best. For me, I started on a quest to figure out, like, what is my golden thread? Like, what is the thing? Because I love change. And I would even beg to say that a part of my personal brand is change. Like, that you really don't know what my hair is going to look like from year to year, and none of it would surprise you. So I think that for me, whenever I was trying to figure out the common theme between everything I've done, it has been that kind of message of being who you are, which whenever I say it out loud, it feels so vague and almost even trite. But I think that that's like really the truth and the essence of everything that drives any work I do. And so for a lot of creatives, you know, that we work with, their deliverables, their offerings, maybe even what it is that they do for a living is going to change, because that's just what we do. Like, as creatives and as entrepreneurs, we're always trying to kind of figure out what's next. But I think that that's where my job gets really interesting, is figuring out, okay, what doesn't change? Like, what about your approach or methodology or philosophy or point of view kind of really stays pretty consistent the whole time? So that's what I do. I don't think I answered your question, though.
No, you totally did. Also, I mean, okay. That's really brilliant, because I think this is something that a lot of people struggle with, right? Like, whether their full-time work is, you know, something that they're doing entrepreneurial, you know, for themselves or not, you know, people even that are choosing to not have that, go that route and, you know, have maybe a more traditional job or are working for someone else, oftentimes will still have some kind of like a side project or something creative, like this idea of kind of mixing personal and professional, or personal and creative, creating some kind of a brand. I think at this point, especially, you know, for a lot of the listeners and just kind of this crowd, I feel like is a really common thing. And questions around this, I think, come up all the time, that like exactly kind of to your point, getting to the heart of what doesn't change. I've never really heard it put quite that way before, but I actually think that's totally brilliant and really insightful, because it's easy to think of more of the surface level things, like, oh, well, I'm a photographer, or I'm, you know, this, and then we define ourselves. That definitely happened to me. I mean, with my story of how I started my business, it was so organic, and it was on the basis of like very lifestyle things, running kind of personal changes, and then you wind up building a brand around that. What happens when those activities change? You know, so I think, and I'm definitely right. Not alone in that. So I think you're speaking to something that's actually really helpful.
Yeah. So I'm curious from you, Nicole, like what do you think is a really common theme? What do you think hasn't changed from going from positioning yourself as a running expert, even though, like, I know that you told us on our podcast that you were starting running. And that's a funny thing too. Like, as creatives, I think it's whenever we share our journey along the way that we accidentally start to almost pigeonhole ourselves in these certain areas. But back to you, going from kind of being known for being a runner to shifting that, what do you think has remained the same? Or even going from like someone who's trying to, or, you know, even you move locations a lot. Like, what doesn't change about you even as you move location? I'm just curious to hear.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a good question. And I think without asking myself this specific question, it's something that I've been at least subconsciously aware of, because I have, you know, definitely a very clear answer, that the through line for me with pretty much all the work that I have done over the last decade, right, that I had started blogging in 2007, right, so essentially a long time ago in internet years, has been this kind of, I don't know, central commitment to telling the truth and having honest conversations, particularly about things that are hard, like being honest about things that are hard and just not being afraid to be messy and imperfect and, you know, to hopefully let other people know that they are not alone like that. I mean, obviously it's kind of a long answer, but something in that space has been, you know, what's been really consistent. I mean, and part of me wrapping up my business at the end of last year and moving in this direction, doing the podcast and, you know, some of these things, it's been really slow and really intentional on purpose, because I feel like I got down to the heart of that. Like, here's what's true, you know, having honest conversations, helping people feel less alone, healing myself out loud, you know, what, anything that falls into that space, and trying to not add things in like a kind of a knee-jerk reaction way, or, oh, I could do this. Oh, I could do this. Like I'm actually purposely, and it's very uncomfortable to slow myself down and to not start the 10,000 projects that I want to start every single day, you know, because of that. Like I'm actually trying not to put myself back into a box that's going to then wind up feeling really constricting. So yeah, it's been a kind of an interesting process to just slow down and, you know, try to only add things that really fit with that kind of core through line message. So yeah, I mean, I think that's a really powerful exercise for anyone.
Yeah. I love that telling the truth is really the core. And I wonder how you feel about it, because like whenever I say my core, you know, in my core, it's being who you are, which is probably very similar to yours, like kind of just at least being honest with yourself. And then I guess for me though, I probably take it one step further where I think, how do you express that truth to other people in a way that, you know, maybe gets you hired whenever it comes to business, or maybe helps you land better relationships whenever it comes to your friends and even romantic relationships. You know, it's just, for me, it's like kind of, how can you express what's going on the inside on the outside so that you are more aligned with what you're attracting and even what you're repelling from your life? So I wonder how you feel, because like I said, I feel almost cheesy or trite or vague saying just be who you are. So whenever it comes down to you telling the truth and being honest, I'm curious like what kind of feelings that brings up in you, like recognizing that that's at the core and that's what doesn't change.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and I totally get what you mean about that. It sometimes can feel like cliche or cheesy, right, to speak in this space. And my issue or struggle or gut reaction to anything along the advice of like, just be yourself is sometimes yeah. I feel like I don't even know who I am. Oftentimes I feel that way. I was having a conversation with my best friend about a week ago. I just recently celebrated my 5-year soberversary, and we were talking, just kind of reflecting on that. And, you know, I was mentioning how kind of the next phase of sobriety or recovery for me is going to be learning how to have fun without alcohol. Because even though it's been 5 years, I still don't feel like I've really answered that question. Not like I do think I enjoy myself, right? But there's a certain kind of fun that used to come with that for me that I haven't really found in any other way. And so this morphed into a conversation about like, what's even fun? What do we like doing? And it was, we were kind of laughing, like, yeah. How are we grown women who we don't know how we want to spend our time, or, you know? And so I think that kind of goes into this idea of, you know, like, just be yourself. That actually to me feels very anxiety producing. Cause I'm like, well, I don't know. Like, I don't know what I like. I'm constantly figuring it out. So I think, you know, when I, you know, going back to that kind of message of honesty or telling the truth, it's more about sharing my real life in real time, kind of that coupled with this principle of healing myself out loud. Whether that sounds cheesy or not, I feel like that's my life purpose or my life work. I don't know necessarily how that work leads to money. If it does, that's a separate conversation. But that to me feels like this question of like, when do I feel most me? It usually is some form of expressing something that's true for me in real time out loud, whether that's through writing or through the podcast or through conversations with friends or, you know, with my husband or something like that. That, that's kind of how I process things. That's, you know, any work that I've done that has gotten positive feedback or, you know, that has cued someone to email me and say, oh my gosh, me too. I'm not the only one. You know, it's always that kind of, here's what's true for me. I have no wisdom for you, but like, this is what's happening. And, you know, so that it's, I don't know, as long as I stay aligned with that and keep that in mind, my feelings around it are all really good. When I tend to get caught up in kind of the ego side of it, you know, and this is always my check for myself in deciding what to share and not share. You know, if I'm about to share something, whether it's a tweet or an Instagram post or, you know, a piece of writing, like, why am I sharing this? Am I sharing this because like, I want people to think that I'm special or brave or fancy or, you know, anything like that? I need to rewrite it because that's not my actual truth. That's my ego truth. And so that's what comes up for me more than anything else is like, who are you trying to be by sharing this? And if it's just this feels true and I need to share it, awesome. Or just something that's like fun and silly, right? Which is like another kind of like lighter truth, I think. Like, this was delightful to me, so I'm going to share it. So I don't know if that answers your question, but...
Yeah, no, I love that. And I love that you mentioned the how do you know who you are? Like whenever people say, just be yourself, like, what does that mean? I have really been digging into that question of how do you know who you are? And that has definitely become like it started guiding my work in major ways. And so what I've become obsessed with recently is asking really good questions. And how do you ask really good questions that help you? I think that in good questions, you find good answers of who you are. And it's an exploration, and it's a question to live in. Like, it's not a question necessarily to ever be answered. Or maybe you're answering it every day in different ways, and that's how you start to... I think the process of becoming who you want to be is how you know who you are.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. Also, I'm obsessed with everything you just said. I want to dig into this a little bit. So I completely agree with the power of asking questions. And I often will have conversations with good friends. And what I ask them is kind of what question or questions do you feel like you are trying to answer, like by living your life right now? Like, what are the questions that are kind of guiding your life? So I'm super curious what some of those really good questions that you feel like you're asking yourself either now or recently.
Ooh, I just journaled some yesterday. Let me grab my notebook because I'm going to get really real here and share those with you. I was recently listening to the Biddy Tarot podcast. Do you listen to that at all?
I do not.
Okay, it's a pretty good one. And I heard that I was listening to your podcast where you had a tarot reader. I can't remember her name.
Teresa Reed. Yeah, she's the best.
Yes, it was so, I loved listening to that. I've recently gotten into using tarot as a tool for asking questions. So I was listening to the Biddy Tarot podcast, and she had a guest on, and she was talking about good questions versus kind of toxic questions, which feels a little harsh, especially growing up hearing there's no such thing as a bad question. But now I'm starting to question that. Like, I think that there might be unproductive questions that just sink us further into, you know, our shit rather than helping bring us to where we want to be. So one of the things that she said for asking good questions, I'm just going to mention this because I'd written it down and I thought it was genius, but for your listeners, go check out the Biddy Tarot podcast. I can't remember which episode I was listening to, but it was, first acknowledging your role in the future and in your ability to change things, and then stating the desired outcome or at least the desired feelings that you want to have. And she said that good questions begin with how or what. And that toxic questions often begin with when and why. So I made a list of questions that I'm just going to read to you and be like super vulnerable here, using this framework of how and what to ask myself some really good questions. So as of 2 days ago, I was asking myself, what kind of mom do I want to be? How can I redefine motherhood? How do I want my marriage to look? How does my physical location affect me? How can I be a better servant to my physical body? What will bring me more laughter? How can I support my husband in his search for a more meaningful career? What do I most deeply desire? How can I show up more authentically? What is authenticity? So that's my list of questions right now.
Damn, girl. Those are some good questions. Which of that beautiful list that you just read, which is the one that feels like has the most energy for you right now or is like the hottest question?
Ooh. I think okay, so the day that I wrote these, my question was, what do I most deeply desire? And I feel like that's a question that keeps coming up over and over again, especially since becoming a mom. It's really easy to lose yourself in that process. And so, like, everything just sounds really exhausting to me right now in some ways. But I don't know. Like, again, like, that's, I think I'm not digging deep enough into the question of what do I deeply desire?
Yeah, I mean, that question, like, what it makes me think of is, like, what are the desires that aren't being met, right? Or something like that. Because anytime I'm in that place of asking myself something, it's because there's obviously, like, if my desires were, whatever they are, all being met, then I wouldn't have that question, right? So.
Right. And I mean, obviously, okay, so if I just close my eyes and like really just without trying to bring language to what I most deeply desire, I'm almost transported back to hiking in the Himalayas, you know, and the foothills of Mount Everest. Like, I desire that. And so even whenever I was talking to you on my podcast, and we didn't really get to talk about it too much, but you were saying that you're about to go on this big hike. And I was like, oh, like I felt some tugs at my heart a little bit, because I desire just putting one foot in front of the other and being in nature. But I don't, here's where I come back around to the mom question, is how do I do that with a 2-year-old?
Yeah.
Because I can't even like get him dressed in the morning. And you know, it's easy to think, before I had a baby, I was like, oh my gosh, I'll just throw him in a backpack and we'll be good to go. But that's really not what it's like. It's so much harder and complicated. And I had all these visions of world travel with my baby. But again, it just sounds exhausting. So I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, this is so real. I like this so much. Because it's basically like what you're speaking to. Of course, I can't relate to having a baby. But it's kind of this space of, here's these questions that I don't know how to answer. Kind of like what I said before, I have no wisdom for you, but here's what's coming up for me. Like, that to me is honestly the most comforting thing. Whether we're asking ourselves, like, I'm maybe not asking myself the same exact questions that you're asking yourself, but I always just find it like, it feels like a warm, comforting hug to hear someone else be like, here are my big question marks. I have no answers. I have this baby. Like, I want to go back to the Himalayas. Like, but, like, that's real. That's real life, right? And like, yeah. this is a reminder for me, you know, because even I can get trapped back to the thing of authenticity, of that authenticity is you have to have a moral to the story and you have to, right? Like this, no, like that it's almost like, I think I get sometimes triggered by what feels like manufactured authenticity, which obviously, yeah, like, you know, whatever, but people trying to prove how real they're being, almost like, look at me, I'm so honest, or I'm so whatever, but everything you just shared, like, that's so real. And that it's, I don't know, just like this principle of, we all have so many questions that we just don't know how to answer, right? And that yeah. I think that is probably like the most common like human emotional experience.
And can I share another question based on everything that you just said? Is sometimes I wonder if my desire for hiking, for a lack of better words, but being in nature, putting one foot in front of the other, breathing, that's kind of like what I can reduce that experience down to, is definitely transformational and spiritual. But is that an old desire that I need to let go of? Do I even really desire that anymore? And I think that's why that's a big question for me right now, is what do I actually most deeply desire? Because I can also close my eyes and see the holidays with my family and being with my brother and sister and putting a jigsaw puzzle together. Like, what if that's all I really desire right now? But then I feel almost like, is that boring? Is that a good story?
Oh my God. So, okay. I mean, yeah. So the next layer of this is then like we have to watch ourselves judge our desires, because that happens, right. You know, that happens to me too. I mean, I get into this kind of judgment place, and I've said this before in other episodes and on, you know, in other conversations, it just tends to keep coming up, that one of the easy judgment things for me is around, am I being a bad feminist? Because a lot of the things that I genuinely love doing are like 1950s housewife things. And like that I really desire the kind of time and space to like clean and organize my home and like do this meal planning and grocery shopping and cooking and baking and all this type of stuff. And then this is obviously just one example, but then I judge that. Like, are you thinking too small? Like, is this you not playing big, or, you know, whatever those cliches or whatever things are? That's funny. It's like one thing to even see the desire, but then we have to go through the whole process of like judging the fact that we want what we want in the first place. And that's where I'm trying to do some of the work, is like letting myself just want what I want, and it doesn't have to mean anything. I basically spent my entire 20s being a story chaser, like doing something for the story. And I think that comes a lot sometimes as a writer or a blogger or anything like that. You start to, and sometimes I think it's good because it can help you get better perspective on a shit situation, you know, like, well, at least this is going to be a good story, or I can, you know, like it helped me in that way. And it also helped me just be more observant because I was looking at things through the eyes of a storyteller, but it didn't allow me to just like let myself be bored or to just chill out or to spend a week doing something that's not quote Instagrammable, you know, or
Right. And so like that's, you know, whenever you said that chasing the story, absolutely I've been chasing the story. And there are a lot of stories that come with motherhood, but I'm really uncomfortable figuring that out loud because I haven't quite figured out what my boundaries are. Like becoming a mom has added a whole new layer of what the fuck am I doing to how I tell stories, how I chase stories. And so I guess like another really good question, I should write this down, is what story am I chasing and what story needs to be told? Because oftentimes I feel this tug of you need to be telling the story of what it means to be a mom and how you're redefining motherhood. So
I'm curious, when you say redefining motherhood, what do you mean by that?
Well, I came into motherhood with some preconceived notions of what that looks like. And, you know, like whenever we talk about unmet desires, there are not very many desires that I have around being a caretaker or being a mom. I love the shit out of my kid. Like, he's the coolest, funniest, most soulful little person. And he's only two. And we have so much fun together. But we also have a lot of not fun together. And there are a lot of things about it where I just feel like impatient or bored or like, why did I do this? Like, what was I thinking? So coming back to your question, wait, what was your question, Nicole?
When you were saying redefining motherhood, I was just curious what that meant.
Yes. So redefining motherhood, I feel like I came into it with all these ideas of what kind of mom I was going to be. And even like, you know, I'm going to be the attachment mom, or I'm going to be the mom that doesn't give a shit, or I'm going to be the mom, you know, even like I'm redefining motherhood from like what it might look like to be a 1950s mom or even just a stay-at-home mom. But what I've learned is I really need to redefine motherhood even aside from those radical notions that I had for myself that maybe aren't the most popular, into maybe something a little bit different or maybe something that's a little bit more conforming. Like, for example, I had this idea before I had my baby that I would just throw him in a backpack and go hiking, and that's the kind of mom I would be. But I think I need to redefine the kind of mom I imagine myself being in order to, I don't know, be happier. Not that I'm like really unhappy, but I don't know. Like, I just wonder if I place some like unfair expectations or boundaries on myself whenever it comes to being a mom.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that makes complete sense to me. Again, like not being able to relate personally to this specific situation, but this comes up a lot for me in conversations that I have with people about change, like, you know, kind of the difficult emotional side of basically like, how do we change our life or how do we deal with changes that are thrust upon us? Or, you know, why is it that sometimes even a change that we said that we wanted has hard things or, you know, anything in that space? Mm-hmm. And the thing that I always come back to for myself is this idea of like fantasy versus reality. Any change that I have made, you know, whether it was something kind of more cut and dry of, you know, an eating change or an exercise change, or there's always a fantasy of this is what I think it's going to be like to be vegan, or this is what I think it's going to be like to be a runner, or, you know, to write a book or to do any of these things. And it's never, ever accurate. And that doesn't mean that the fantasy is wonderful and reality is the worst, right? Like that would be too easy. But it means that I'm always going to be unhappy and dissatisfied with the reality if I can't accept that the reality is different than the fantasy. So I totally hear that in what you're saying, that this idea of, you know, I had this very clear vision. now that it's not that way, if I don't let go of that vision and open myself up to, you know, the good, the bad, the messy, the, you know, glorious of what's actually happening, I'm going to be unhappy. And I think that's true for a lot of us in tons of different situations, right? Whether that's marriage or motherhood, or even I feel this way a lot, with like working for yourself, freelancing, being an entrepreneur.
100%.
Like it's really like societally glorified. Like it's, you know, like break out of the cubicle, quit your 9 to 5. And I mean, if that's actually a good fit for you and that's what you want to do, that's awesome. But it's not this like amazing hearts and stars and unicorns situation that I think a lot of people on the internet try to make it out to be.
That is such a good point. And I don't think that you have to be a mom to learn the kinds of life lessons that you want to learn. And I've seen so many links, especially between being a creative entrepreneur and being a parent. And, but for me, I've definitely, becoming a mom has been a way that I'm learning a lot of lessons. My son has become one of my greatest teachers. But yeah, I mean, anyone, like, I think that these are universal feelings and just common humanity, regardless of your situation or circumstances or family life. You articulated that so much more beautifully. Like, thank you for giving words to really what I've been grappling with a little bit.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's nice to have honest conversations, you know, even around this idea that the motherhood conversation has been coming up for me a lot lately, because I'm, you know, perfectly happy being open about the fact that I don't want to have kids. And people always have a lot of questions about that, right? So I'm always interested in the other side of it too. Like, did you, was this something that you always knew that you wanted, or, you know, what kind of, what was that like for you?
Absolutely not. I was so 50-50, and I've never met, I recently met one other person like this, and it was at a kind of mastermind retreat that our mutual friend, Sarah Von Bargen, held in Mexico. And so there was a gal there, and she was like, I'm so split 50-50 on whether or not to have a kid. And I was there too. And so I told her, and only one other person has told me this, was don't do it. Like, if you're 50-50, like really on the line of whether or not you want to have a kid, like just don't do it. Give yourself permission to be okay with not having a kid. And of course, like, I want to tell her there's so many beautiful things about having a child, and it will, you know, layer your life in ways that you haven't, you couldn't even expect or anticipate. But if you're perfectly happy not having a child and you don't see any need and your partner doesn't have any need for children, just don't do it. Because I think that that's whenever it's maybe how much of this desire to have a child is from external pressures. But I could totally, like, I always tell people, I kind of actually think of myself as a child-free person who has a kid.
Interesting. Okay, so you said that you were kind of on the fence 50-50. What was it that made the decision for you?
Well, my husband jizzed inside of me and I got pregnant.
Oh my God, can that be the pull quote from this episode?
Right.
So, okay. All right. So it wasn't a, hey, I've changed my mind, let's do this.
No, not at all. And I did kind of give myself, you know how some people give themselves like a smoking cutoff date? Like, I'm going to quit on this date. So I was like, it was actually 3 years ago today, because it's my birthday. I was like on my birthday, on my 30th, I guess 31st birthday. I can't, no. Sorry, I'm so bad at math. Let's just say it was my 30th birthday. I was like, on my 30th birthday, we're just going to, you know, see what happens. Because that was another thing, is I had a lot of friends that struggled with fertility, and our birth control, can we get like really real here? Do you think your listeners will mind?
We can get as real as you want, my dear.
Okay. So our birth control method is pulling out, and we had been doing that for, I don't know, a long time, and never got pregnant, never had pregnancy scares. At the same time, I've had a lot of friends who have struggled with fertility. So I kind of had this thought of, what if we can't even get pregnant and I'm like, have all this anxiety over nothing. So the first time we did it, and I really have a hard time sharing this story because I don't want anyone with fertility issues to feel bad or mad or whatever. This is how I feel whenever people tell me that their kids probably sleep for 8 hours a night every night since they were born. But the first time we did it, I just had a feeling, and this is where spirituality can kind of start to enter the conversation. I just had a feeling that we were making a baby. And so I did almost say a little prayer, like, dear universe, if I'm getting pregnant right now, please send me the baby that was meant for me. And so in that moment, and then I forgot about it. And a few weeks later, I was like crying about how big the world felt. And so I poured myself a big glass of wine and it tasted like vinegar. And I was like, huh, maybe I'm pregnant. And I was. Sorry, I feel like I'm really going off on a tangent now. I'm telling that whole story.
No, there's no such thing as a tangent. Okay. Everything you say is something that needs to be heard. So I'm into it.
We're having coffee right now, like just chatting. So anyway, I found out that I was pregnant and I was genuinely very excited. And then I thought, this is going to be a new adventure. It's going to be amazing. But what I really want to say, what I want to tell people is that nothing about this for me feels like adventure as I define it. Like, it feels like hard fucking work. It feels like a daily grind.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm just going to give that a minute because there's so much that you just said that is, I think, really wonderful. I mean, and for something that I am working on right now, this is kind of my theme of the month or maybe even the theme of the year / my life, is working on trusting myself more. And that I have traditionally had, I always say, oh, well, I don't have very strong intuition or I don't any of these things. When actually that's not true. I have it. I just don't trust it and I don't allow myself to act on it. And the baby thing is definitely kind of an area where I work on that, because I always just assumed that I would have children in that kind of white picket fence, this is what you do when you're an adult type of way, right? It was part of my picture in just an abstract, that's what you do, you know, whoever they are, that they say that. And I remember super vividly, we're talking about birthdays, like marking time, when I turned 27, there was something about that age for me that felt like, and I, you know, I was in a really stable relationship with a wonderful person. And it was the first time that I thought, oh, this could happen. Like, this is no longer, you know, it's not like I'm 21 and if I got pregnant, it's like, this is real. Like, this is an age at which, you know, people would not be scandalized or, you know, whatever. And it was the first time that I thought about it in anything other than kind of this vague abstract future. And it was this just like unbelievable, oh no, I don't want that. And it was like one of the clearest intuition hits that I have ever had. And it's been an interesting process to have to keep trusting that, because, you know, when people ask me about, you know, not wanting to have kids, and I've actually gotten some emails, because I mentioned this a couple seasons ago. I had my friend Jackie Carr on and she just had her baby, but she was super pregnant at the time. And, you know, I had gotten emails from people that want to hear more about this topic. So I'm glad that it came up for us. But and my kind of answer is, I feel like I would be very stressed out if I was 50-50. Like, if I felt like being in a place of indecision in any way for me is the most stressful circumstance. When I feel the pressure of having to make a decision, that's when I am that's like the biggest kind of depression trigger for me, or just anything like that. And so for me, I feel 100% sure that I don't want kids. So either that's going to reverse itself in the next however many years. And if so, okay, then I've changed my mind. It doesn't mean that how I feel right now isn't true, but I'm not naive enough to think that this is how I'm going to feel forever, right? But yeah, just any time though, I start to think, well, you know, what if I regret this, or what? I'm like, no, just trust yourself. Like, you feel that this is true, and trust that if that truth changes, you will feel that as well. And it's, I don't know, it's really been an interesting process.
I think that, there's so many things that you just said that triggered so many more thoughts. But on the indecision, making decisions is my superpower. I feel like I can just make a decision and go with it and it's no big deal. But making the decision to have a kid is probably the biggest, weightiest decision I ever felt. And honestly, I feel like I would have probably leaned on the side of like 75% sure I'm not having a kid. And I probably could have made that decision and just gone with it until, like you, if I change my mind, great. But my husband does want children. And right now we're even talking about, are we going to have more? And the other day I told him, I said, I'm done. Like, I don't want any more children. And that, like, I feel pretty solid about that decision, even though it's just as hard as deciding whether or not to have Fox. But one thing, whenever I was at this mastermind in Mexico with a few other women, that the girl I was talking to who was trying to decide 50-50 if she wanted a baby or not, one of the things that she said that has really stuck with me is that no matter what you decide, you're going to be mourning something. You're going to be grieving something. So what is it that you want to grieve? Do I want to grieve the life of like this second baby who could be, you know, one of my little soulmates and or someone who could change the world or, you know, whatever that might look like, whatever that fantasy is? Or do I want to grieve everything else that, you know, comes along with the freedom of only having one child or not having any children? You know, like, so either way, you're going to have to mourn something. So which thing would you rather mourn? And right now, I'd rather mourn that second child not ever happening than mourn this idea that, like, I'm going to feel trapped or caged or, like, I can't go on adventures and, yeah.
Yeah, that's a brilliant question. I was having a conversation just yesterday with a dear friend, you know, who was in the position of making a tough choice. And one of the things she was asking for advice. And one of the things that I said, that I didn't realize how true it was until after I said it and then thought about it, you know, for a good hour after she left, was if I think back to, you know, times when I had felt like I had like a really big weighty decision to make that was really weighing on me. The hardest part has been falling into the false belief that the quote right decision will present itself and it will just feel right. I think sometimes that happens if we're talking about kind of this big intuition hit of I just knew, right? I think that happens sometimes, but in my experience, that's actually rather rare. It's the same kind of category of advice of when you meet the right person, you just know and it just works. Yeah. Does that happen for some people? Sure. But I think that sometimes it's almost like we have this like Disney princess fantasy of like the quote right decision. And, you know, the most freeing thing for me has been what if either decision is going to have pain attached to it? And that if that's okay, yeah. Because one of the ways that I keep myself stuck is, well, if this was the right option for me, then I would know, I would feel it, right? But I think your point that you just made about that there's always something to grieve, that's, I don't know, I find that to be very, very freeing because in my, even though I feel certain right now that having children is not what I want to do, that's not the path that I want to take, what I feel like I'm grieving is, this might sound very strange, but a future, you know, 30 plus years from now of having adult children. Like I do have a fear of being really lonely when I'm old, you know, that it's neither my husband or I have very big families. We're not really close to that many people in our family. You know, we don't have this, we all live in the same town and all the cousins come over for Sunday at all. I didn't grow up that way, you know?
Right.
And so I foresee, okay, well, if it's just him and I, and then all of a sudden, however, you know, 40 years from now, and we're old, am I going to be really lonely? And that, for me, that's the thing that I'm grieving. The grief has not outweighed the desire to not have a child, but that, yeah, you just put words to that.
That is exactly what I grieve too. And I think that it's that I grieve my own experience of me and my siblings getting together on the weekends with my parents every single weekend. Like, we have a really tight family. It's not huge, but we're tight. And so here's my answer to that. And here's what I think that I would answer if I had chosen to not have children. And like, even now I'm like, oh my God, Fox could grow up to be a drug addict and we're not going to have this idyllic grown-up relationship that I'm fantasizing about. Because like we've mentioned, sometimes the reality does not match up. Now, like I will say prayers to the end of the world that like my son does not become an addict. But at the same time, it's like, okay, so here's what I wanted to say to you is, what if I'm lonely? Well, are you lonely right now? And can you trust that you're going to be able to fill your life in really rich ways that don't involve children whenever you're older?
Yeah. Well, I mean, and so that, it's funny, the thing that has come up for me in like, I didn't even realize that I was grieving this thing until, look at you, you're like giving me all these epiphanies, until that, but kind of putting words to it, like really solidifies things for me. And I'm realizing that in a lot of ways, it would be easy to make casual throwaway comments about how not having children is the easier choice. And I obviously, in some ways, I'm sure that it is, because like you said, it's hard fucking work, right? But I think what I'm kind of coming to realize, or kind of has come out of some of my recent, you know, journaling experiences, and writing is how I know myself, basically, whether that's mm-hmm. writing for other people or writing for myself, is that it actually, there's, I think, a lot of work that I have to do on myself, using like the loneliness as an example. Like, I'm definitely really prone to that and prone to isolating and that kind of stuff, that if I had, and obviously I'm just projecting, I have no idea what it would be like to have a child, sure. but I have this vision in my head, like that if that were to be a path, that it's almost that there's so much commotion and there's so much activity and just conversations I've had with other friends who are, you know, parents and have young children and that kind of stuff, that I feel almost like that would be an easy, obviously hard in some ways, way to answer this question. Like, it's almost like I have to challenge myself to, okay, go one more step. Like, if I'm not going to, because that's, I don't think that's reason enough to have a child. I don't think that's fair, right, for me to do that. So if I'm choosing not to do that, but I'm also choosing not to be lonely, all right, Nicole, like, you have some work to do to figure out like how to meet your needs yeah. and desires in other ways that feel more true for you, like not going for the low hanging fruit. And, you know, I remember speaking to someone when I was in college, who was quite a bit older, was, you know, basically my parents' age. And she said to me, you know, she had three children who were, you know, basically like grown at that point. And she said that she oftentimes, like, she loved them, but she was like, I oftentimes wish that I hadn't had kids. And that was the only time I've ever heard anyone say like that. To me felt like hugely revelatory. And I think about that a lot. And, you know, she said the reason that I had kids was because of external pressure, because that was like what I thought I had to do to like be a good woman and be a good, and it was just this like very honest moment. I'm like, yeah, that's not enough of a reason for me to have kids. Anyway, so yeah, there's like a lot of good stuff here that
That. So whenever I was in Mexico with those girls and one of them was having a hard time deciding whether or not she wanted to have kids, I felt the same thing. So actually my co-host Emily on Being Boss, we were really just work buddies. And one day I was talking to her about this really hard decision to make about whether or not to have kids. And she's the only person, okay, and my sister, who also has two children, has told me this. So Emily has a daughter, and all of these people in my life love their kids. I think that that should go without saying, but their honesty in telling me don't do it, like just don't do it, was so liberating. And then in some ways, I felt like it liberated me to make the decision, like, okay, now I have permission to not have kids. What permission do I need to give myself now? And so I want to come back around to that trusting yourself component. And as soon as I became pregnant with Fox, and even every day since then, I've had to make the deliberate choice to trust my life, and to not only trust my life, but to trust Fox, and to trust that he is here to fulfill his own karma or destiny or whatever that looks like for him. And then coming back around to making the right decision. My thing with decisions is that I don't really believe that there is any, I don't believe in right or wrong in general. Like, obviously, like, it's not cool to go around and kill people or whatever, but I think that there are so many complexities and nuances to decision making and to like what is, you know, quote unquote, right and what is wrong. I think it's just such a personal decision for someone, especially when it comes to like just how it affects you. That if you can just make a decision and commit to it, that is going to move you forward. And trusting that whether or not you make the right decision or the wrong decision, trusting that it's going to move you forward is huge. And I think that that is so liberating versus like freaking out and getting paralyzed over the options.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I think that the way that we grow is through making decisions, because you decide, you commit, and then whatever happens next, right? You have to work through it. You have to, you know, whatever. And I agree with you. I think that there are very few kind of fundamentally you know, black and white, right and wrong decisions, right? And maybe people's different moral compass would lead them to say there are a couple of ones they believe are different than someone else's. But that idea of, am I making the right decision on things that are maybe not as huge as, do I go around killing people or not, right? That I can sometimes get trapped there too. Like I make, and obviously having children, I think is a big decision. But even if we move away from that topic into just more of the, what we were talking about like life indecision in general, that I keep myself stuck by even believing that there is one right decision and one wrong decision.
Yes.
And come on, Nicole, you better pick it, because otherwise, you know, everything's the worst. And just kind of what if that's not true? Like, what if there is no like categorically right decision? And, you know, that, like you said, it either way, like you're going to grow through just the process of like having made a choice.
Okay. I have a question for you about your hike that's coming up. How did you decide to do that? Like, what was your decision-making process? And was at any point, were you ever scared, or did you ever feel like, did you ever have to weigh anything there and make some hard decisions?
Yes.
Or was that totally easy?
No, that's a really good question. This is fun. Obviously, I'm really excited about this adventure, so totally down to talk about it. For anyone listening, the hike that she is referring to, in August, I'm going to be going on hopefully a four-week, solo backpacking trip. I'm hiking the Oregon section of the Pacific Crest Trail, which is wildly different than anything I've ever done. Like, I have no experience. Like, I've never gone backpacking one night in my life. So like, this is completely, completely new for me. So how did I make this decision? What's the nutshell version of this? Or maybe not even the nutshell. What's the full version of this story? So going back, you know, 5 years, I mentioned that I had just celebrated my 5-year soberversary. So I quit drinking and started running on the same day, and had never been an athlete or done anything even remotely athletic or outdoorsy. I grew up in Manhattan and in London, had never, you know, being outdoors, being in nature is not something that my parents ever cared about or valued. I'm very, very much like was raised a city girl and, you know, an indoor kid, meaning books, museums, like, you know, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And running was really a way out of the drinking hole for me. I needed to do something that was so hard and so all-consuming that I knew that basically I had a place to channel all of the energy that I used to channel drinking and being a party girl. And I just needed something that was basically going to be it was transferring addictions for sure, which in the long run maybe isn't an effective strategy, but in the short run oftentimes is and is very necessary. And I don't think that I would have quit drinking without having running. So, you know, it was, and I ran really consistently, was completely obsessed with it for about 4 years. And it was an unbelievable arena of self-growth for me. It was the first time that I had ever started something, realized very quickly that I was terrible at it and didn't quit, which had always been my pattern in the past. I don't like to do things that I'm not good at. I was always raised more praising results than praising hard work. So I didn't really value the just inherent worthiness of working hard and pushing yourself, which I learned completely through running. That was how I learned that I am strong, that I can do hard things, that, you know, the only way to get to really big, sexy results is to do like one very unsexy step at a time, kind of every single day. Running is what really helped me, I wouldn't say cure, but definitely make big strides with my procrastination, because as opposed to, let's say in college, writing, you know, a paper, you can leave it till the last minute and cram it. Like, you can't not run at all and then run all your miles in one day. Like, that no work, right? So,
right.
Like, there was definitely, like, it was just basically one enormous life lesson after another through that period of time. And so it was about 4 years. And it was actually right around my 4-year soberversary, I realized that I had not been enjoying running at all for probably about 6 weeks at that point. And I'm very familiar with, just because you love something doesn't mean you love it every day, and you don't have to be in the mood to do something in order to do it. All lessons I learned through running. But it had been enough of a, you know, 6 weeks is long enough. And I know the difference between, I don't really want to go out and do this run, but then afterwards I'm glad that I did it. And it had been about 6 weeks where I didn't have that feeling, where I was like, I don't want to be doing this. And I was on what was supposed to be, you know, a 2+ hour trail run, and I was, you know, more than halfway through it. So I was pretty far out, like into the woods. I was just so miserable. Physically, I was fine, but I was just so unhappy. I stopped running, burst into tears, and I was like, I'm done with this. And I had to a very long walk back to my car. And, you know, for me at that time, I was training for my first ultra marathon. And I realized the question that I asked myself that wound up being very freeing, and I've told this story before, but was if you couldn't put a photo from the finish line of this ultra marathon on Instagram, would you still do it? And it was such
a... So that's where you learned that ego lesson.
Yes, yes. Or that was kind of the clearest representation of it. And it was such like an unbelievable no. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm all about posting things that you're excited about. But for me, I realized in that moment, there's a difference between I worked really hard for something and achieved it or ran this race or did whatever. And I'm like intrinsically, inherently really proud of it. And also I want to share it because I'm excited versus the only reason that I'm doing this is because I want people to think X, Y, or Z about me. So I was like,
that's such a good way to distinguish that too, because I often even think about my Everest experience. Like, was I just chasing a story? Did I just go to Mount Everest to blog about it? But I would have done that either way. And I love that you explain that difference and that clarification. That's huge. Thank you.
I think
I'm like
part
writing
of,
it down.
I think part of the joy of any experience and how to, you know, if you look at like happiness science or anything like that, talking about the happy thing, sharing the happy thing, like that's kind of a way to suck more enjoyment out of something, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm all about that. But that has to come after, you know, I have to have done it for a reason other than that first. And so I realized that and I thought, okay, well, you're done. So I had this, you know, very long walk through the woods back to my car to think about that. Excuse me. And this was the day after my 4-year soberversary. And I also in that time had a realization that being sober and running had become so linked for me that I was subconsciously afraid that if I stopped running, that I would start drinking again. And so running was no longer fun because it felt like something that I had to do. And I was like, all right, it's time to like make a break from this. So I didn't run for 6 months. And like from that day, I basically stopped running. And I really honestly needed to prove to myself that I had moved far enough in my recovery. And so I, you know, stopped running and didn't start drinking. And then I never really found, I mean, I've run obviously since then and had some starts and stops, but I never really found my way back to it because I realized that whatever role it filled for me or whatever I needed from it, all that growth had happened. And I felt like running didn't have anything to teach me anymore in that kind of fundamental way. But I really value growth. Like that's definitely one of my, you know, you mentioned authenticity is one of your core values. Growth is absolutely one of mine. And I find growth through a lot of times, like through physical things. It can't just be like just thinking. And so I was very open to, I not necessarily want something to replace running, but I'm sure there's always more growth that we have to do and it needs to be in a different arena. So I tried a bunch of things, you know, I was interested in kickboxing and some different kinds of yoga. And, you know, so I started doing things and they were all fine, but it wasn't what I was looking for. And one of the reasons that my husband and I moved to Bend was because we wanted access to nature. And I really, that was something I felt a calling for that based on nothing. Like I had only ever lived in big cities, but it felt really true. And it felt like something to explore. So I started going out there and, you know, hiking more and doing this and, fell kind of down the rabbit hole of, I read this book, by a woman named Carrot Quinn called Through Hiking Will Break Your Heart, which I've talked about a lot because I'm obsessed with it. And it was about her through hike of the PCT and just the combination of her writing style. And I think she turned 31 during the hike. Anything that I had read about people doing these things usually tended to be younger. And I sometimes succumb to that. Well, I didn't do this in my 20s. So like my chances, I'm too old now, you know, whatever, like should have had the adventures, whatever that story is. And so something about her, just her experience like was, there's another thing. Like what really appeals to me about a long distance hike is that it feels like a pilgrimage sort of, or some kind of a quest or a getting from one place to another. And that was part of what I liked about running. And so I thought, I don't know, like it's kind of hard to articulate, but like I just felt in a deep way that it was getting under my skin the same way that running did at the beginning. Like that same energy of I want to read all the books. And then I read so many memoirs of people, you know, who had done all kinds of long distance hikes. And then I started researching gear and all the geeky things that I did with running at the beginning. And then I also realized the whole other element of I don't know how to outdoors. Like, I don't, how do I put up a tent? How do you find water? How do you filter water? How do I not get eaten by a mountain lion? How do I, like, I sat down and made a list of everything I'm afraid of. It's like the biggest list ever. Yeah. I don't know how to read a map. I mean, I'm going to take a class at the beginning of June, but so I realized just through all of that, that like, okay, here's my really fertile ground for self-growth. And so that's kind of how, I mean, that's a very long answer to your question, but that's kind of how that came up for me. And in terms of like, yeah, I'm totally scared. I mean, it's going to be hard. My husband and I are together all day, every day. We both work from home. We're both kind of homebodies. We're kind of obsessed with each other. We spend an inordinate amount of time together. So being away for 4 weeks, I think will be really hard. I'm really sad to be away from my cats, you know, for that long.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's like tons of fears and things. I mean, this is still, you know, like at this point, you know, almost 3 months out by the time this episode airs, you know, 2 months out. So I'm sure there's still stuff I haven't thought of to be afraid of yet. But yeah, so there's definitely were some hard decisions, but kind of to bring this back to the kid thing, part of actually what helped me make this decision was a conversation that Paul, my husband, and I had together. He is a cyclist and, you know, super into racing bikes and that kind of stuff, which is not a cheap hobby, right? And it's a time consuming hobby too, right? Like he'll go out for these 6 hour rides or any of this type of stuff. And, you know, I was saying, I feel guilty leaving for 4 weeks, right? And, you know, he basically said to me, he was like, we're making the choice not to have children. And you know, while there are some the grieving to do with that, not that he used those words, but like you just said, there's also, you know, there's benefits that we get and, you know, that privileges, and we have more disposable income and we have more time and so what are we doing if we're not using that? Like we're making this choice and then not taking advantage of the things that come with that choice. And I don't remember the exact words he used, but that was really helpful for me to be like, yes, it's a place of privilege to be able to take 4 weeks out of my life and do this and have a partner that's really supportive and have that not be a huge financial impediment. And I'm really grateful for that. But I don't know. Like I'm making these choices in my life and it's fine to take advantage of the benefits of those choices.
So a couple of things that came up when we were sharing that story that I really love and have more questions about is I love that you have like little fears, like how am I going to filter my water? And these are the little fears that came up for me in having a child. Like they're not fears that came up for me whenever I quit my job or anything else, but I was like, oh my God, I don't know how to use a breast pump. Like, and that seems so overwhelming. And now I can look back and laugh at that because it's just not a big deal. And I like acknowledging that these little fears sometimes can be like add up to feel bigger than they are. But, and I don't even know where I'm going with that other than little fears are also real fears. And so I love the idea that you could like even write those down and figure out, okay, what am I actually afraid of? And can I learn how to do this? And will that squash some of my anxiety about this? But my other question is about you, like with growth, because I'm obsessed with growth too. I feel like a student of life. For fun, I love reading books on like psychology or self-help or memoirs of other people's growth and lessons learned. So I'm curious for you, because sometimes I'm like, what is it all for? Because we're all going to die. And I think that's where I have to like start to tap into my spirituality a little bit. So I'm curious for you if there's any link between growth and spirituality and like where you land on the spectrum there.
Yeah. So, oh my God, you're so insightful. Look at all your smart points. So I want to just quick touch on the thing that you said before about, you know, big fears kind of versus smaller fears. I shared before that being in a place of indecision is like one of the worst feelings for me. And oftentimes what leads to that is some kind of fear. Like I'm pretty convinced at this point that like every, you know, element of procrastination or overwhelm or indecision, like it's all based in fear. Like fear is basically the root of everything, I think, like in that regard. And, you know, because I hate being stuck and I hate being in that place, the only tactical tool that I know that works for me on a consistent basis is to like name the component, like, because the fear is always like the sum of the parts, right? And it becomes larger than the sum of the parts. And the only way for me to move past fear, like the kind of cliches of like, don't let fear control you, or like send fear to the back of the bus, or, like, that doesn't work for me. Just, it doesn't work. Like, I have to get to the heart of what's true without judgment, like in my fears. So like for me with this hike, I needed to actually break down and like and allow myself to put names to every single thing that I'm afraid of. And this has happened in business, in relationships, in other things, because then I can actually see them and I can then more objectively say, okay, well, this one's unrealistic. Like, this is just, you know, an emotional, whatever. Okay, that's fine. Right. Like, I'm afraid I'm going to be lonely out there. Any of those things, like, there's nothing I can to do. There's no action steps to take. It's just, I acknowledge that that's a fear. I don't know fantasy versus reality, how that's actually going to play out. I accept that that's a fear that I don't know until I know, and I move on. Versus like the very real things that, to your point, do stand in our way. Like, it's these small things that we, again, with the judgment, like, we judge whether that's even like a worthwhile enough fear. Like, cause right, you're not saying like, I almost didn't have a baby because I didn't know how to use a breast pump. Right. But these are the things, like, for people that are starting their own business, or, you know, that it can be the, I'm really overwhelmed with like the basics of starting a website, right? Like, that could be a seemingly small thing that's enough to get someone to not do it, right? So for me to name, okay, I'm actually really afraid that I'm going to get lost. I have no sense of direction. Like, Google Maps could drive me into a river and I probably like would follow it. Okay, that is a fixable problem. REI does teach like beginner map and compass navigation classes. Okay, here's my $30. I'm going to go take that class, right? So, and the water filter situation. Okay, so now I have a water filter. I haven't used it yet, but I will, right? So being able to kind of systematically separate, here are the fears, because they're all real. Here are the fears that I can do something about. Here are the fears that I can't. And then starting to work through the ones that I can do something about helps me deal with the other. You know, so I don't know if that's been your experience as well, but...
Yeah, totally. And I think that taking inventory of all those fears and really listing them out is so smart. And then you can start to get into like, what is the worst case scenario? I think that hiking presents itself with a lot of worst case scenarios, because like, you could get eaten by a bear, or you could get like a really terrible, sorry, not to like list really scary things that you're about to embark on, but there are also like really scary things that come with pregnancy. Like, I think that whenever it comes to, is this life or death? And you're like, actually, yeah, it probably could be life or death. I think that there's a lot of growth that comes from facing those fears and seeing it through and seeing what happens.
Oh yeah, and, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it was funny. I was having a conversation. My friend Zach Davis, this is actually funny. He was on the first season of the show. He hiked the Appalachian Trail some years ago, and that was what that episode was about. But that was way before I was even interested in this. So it would be funny for me to go back and listen to the questions that I asked. But I'm sure he also was part of like planting this seed for me. But, you know, so when I decided to do this hike, was, you know, he's been really helpful in terms of just like tactical gear questions and stuff, and just me texting him frantically all my fears. And, you know, when I was making a list, on the list, one of the things I said to him was like, fear of getting eaten by a mountain lion, like slash other, you know, things. And his response back, he was like, if you get eaten by a mountain lion, like, it's your time, right? And yeah. I know that he was like kind of saying that in jest, but even with that fear, like, the only practical steps I can take are to identify like what the potentially dangerous wildlife might be in the area that I'm going to be hiking, read as much as I can on what are the best practices to do if I were to encounter, you know, this animal versus this animal, arm myself with that knowledge. And then like, literally that's it. Like, if I get attacked by a mountain lion, I get attacked by a mountain lion. I'm much more likely to die in a car crash like today on the way to the grocery store. Right. So like, there's not to say that like, it's not real. You know, my mom's like so terrified when I told her I was going on this trip, she burst into tears immediately. But at some point it is what it is, right? Like, you're either going to have a really difficult pregnancy or you're not, you know, like it's,
and, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because I almost went there like, well, and if you die, you die. And I'm known for doing this, like, even with my coaching clients who are so afraid of writing something really vulnerable. Sometimes like it really comes down to the worst thing that can happen is that you'll die one day, you know, and it's going to happen to all of us. And I don't mean to like put light to dying, but really think about like, what is your fear around dying? And So my biggest fear of, like, let's say having a baby and dying in childbirth, which was like a legit fear, like as your body feels like it's being split open. But even in that moment, I didn't care. Like, I could have died and not cared. But is like, oh my gosh, but then my husband and baby and leaving them behind. But that's not even my fear. You know, I'm starting to like project fears onto them that aren't even real.
Also, so, you can't control that. Like, I mean, exactly, like to the point of, I wouldn't say that hiking is a high risk activity, right? As if, like, right, we're not talking about, I'm getting into base jumping or I'm gonna, you know, like, there are things that are inherently, and again, there's nothing wrong with that if that's what you want to do. But so I had to also kind of check myself with, like, I'm not like, let's go like ride motorcycles in the rain or, you know, whatever. Like, I'm right, not, I'm not seeking out things that are going to increase the death risk, you know, extremely so. But on the other hand, like this for me, my, I feel like everyone has lots of issues, but I think that most people or everyone has kind of a core, like personal, you mentioned Everest, but like personal Everest to climb as far as self-development mm-hmm. goes, that like every lesson tends to lead back to that. And for me, it's control and surrender. Like, I want to control all the things. Like, I want to control all the things. And that's my perpetual lesson. Like, almost everything goes back to that. All, pretty much all the fears of the hiking have to do with that. Well, what if it's, what if there's a lightning storm and what if, and hypothermia that, well, because I want to control the whole experience and I want this to be the weather and there to be no mountain lions and surrender, which is like very hard for me, but it's pretty much always the answer.
And you know, the truth of it is that in those experiences that you can't control and you roll with, those often make the best stories, and being writers, that's still what we're chasing. And so I know for me, you know, going to Everest, it was always in the unexpected things that I found the best lessons and the best stories. So in some ways, like, let's embrace that. And I also want to just clarify, just for people, maybe those of you who haven't had children, like what I learned through that experience is that really our bodies are built to do this, and that most likely we're not going to die, and that we have modern medicine available and it's all good. Well, but just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, but I also think, I mean, with the hiking parallel too, that, you know, we as a species or whatever have gotten really far from what our natural situation is, right? In terms of like being able to survive in the wild or do any of this stuff. Like, that's something that, you know, however many, however far back we want to go in our ancestral tree, like that was what happened, right? So part of that for me is also a reminder of like, this isn't some insane thing that I'm trying to do, right? Like, I can sleep on the ground. Like, it's going to be fine. And so you asked a question that now I don't remember your exact question, or brought up a topic about growth and spirituality.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, just in general, I would love to hear where you are on the spiritual spectrum, because for me, whenever I think about all this growth, and sometimes I torture myself with growth, like sometimes I feel like I'm trying to expand my container for growth so much that it almost feels like suffering. That's a little dramatic, but sometimes I'm like, what is this all for? Like, it would be so much easier to just be a lemming who goes through life without thinking about it all the time and to not be so obsessed with growth. And I think that's where the spirituality component comes in for me. Because sometimes I'm like, whatever, we're all going to die. Like, why do I need to learn these lessons? And then that's where the spiritual side comes in, where I do believe that maybe there's something more, or that maybe I believe in having a soul, and I believe that my soul is in my physical body here on earth to learn and glean certain lessons that I could not learn being whatever, like an ethereal spirit out in the universe or whatever it looks like. So I realize that like sometimes I'm going through hard lessons for deeper learnings that maybe I can take with me from beyond this life. And if that sounds like really hippie and woo, I go there a little bit, but there are some like really practical, tactical, tangible here in this world things that go along with that. But I'm curious for you, kind of having this obsession with growth, I'm curious if there is any spiritual component for you, or like the kind of the why behind the need for growth.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, this is another one of my favorite topics and another place where I feel like I have a lot of questions and no wisdom. But My best friend Jamie and I get in this conversation all the time of like, you know, what's the point? Like, what? Like, kind of like yeah. you said. Well, we're just gonna die. So, like, why do I care so much about, you know, insert X thing here or whatever? Like, this creative project. Why do I care about this podcast? Why do I care? Like, shouldn't I just like go back to drinking and like have fun and like not give a shit? Right. And honestly, some like I have to talk that out sometimes. Like, you know, we get into this. It's funny in the I don't know what the actual emoji means, but there's an emoji that's basically like a it's like a blue spiral. And this is really weird. You're getting into my inner whatever. There's a blue spiral emoji, and then there's another emoji that I don't know if it's a pothole or whatever, but like it looks like a black hole. And so that's like when we text each other, basically like those emojis, it means like I am like spiraling, like the downward depression spiral into the deep dark hole of like nothing matters, what am I doing with my life, like huge existential crisis. So it's kind of like that's the SOS, like you need to call me, because like blue spiral dark hole. And it's always around this kind of stuff, like this fundamental, like what's the point of everything. I mean, even with like all the political stuff and everything that's going on, like I do get to this like complete other end of the spectrum place of like, I give up, I quit. Like I yeah. just, so yeah, like I definitely yeah. feel that. I think newer to whatever, I mean, if we're going to use like the cliche phrase of spiritual journey or whatever, I think that I'm kind of like newly waking up to that and to that being important to me, and to surrounding myself with either like books or thoughts or ideas that I don't know necessarily to try to answer these questions, but are definitely talking in that space. But I think that that's why a lot of people turn to something spiritual, is because of the inability to have any other answers to these questions, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's definitely something that I'm searching for. And I think that that is a big component of the hike as well. Like I mentioned kind of the pilgrimage before, and obviously that has like a very spiritual religious connotation for a reason. And I think the only thing that's really helpful for me when I get into the, you know, why am I doing this? Why does this matter? Whatever, is just, I don't know, but it does. Like that it matters. Like I have to just believe that it matters. You know, and to your point about growth, I think, again, there's a difference. I jokingly, but not so jokingly, call myself a recovering self-help addict, because I went way too far down that like rabbit hole of really believing that my life is a problem to be fixed. And everyone, and not trusting myself and giving my power away, because everyone's 30-day e-course and book and webinar, like they can tell me how to fix myself. And I really reacted badly to that after like some years of doing it. It didn't work for me. It was too much. It was like not a good place to be, that everything in my life, like it was a problem to be fixed. And I constantly, well, I need to be working out this way and eating this way. And well, I'm not meditating, so that's bad. And this, and I was just miserable. And so that's when I was like, okay, I'm done like pursuing this like commercial self-help, whatever. And again, I'm going to like go inward and trust myself. And when I feel, oh, here's an area in which I would really like to grow, then I can look out, you know, search out or research tools that might help with that thing that I've already identified that I want to do. So it's again, kind of like checking the motivations for it. Cause I think that that can be like definitely an addiction, like trying to like fix ourselves.
Yes. I love that you say that too, because I go through phases where I'm like, oh my God, I'm so done with self-help. I'm so done reading about how to live my life, and I just want to live my life. And so then I get into cycles of wanting to read memoirs, or wanting to read like how other people are living their lives, or wanting to read just some fun fiction. So I love that you say that, because I go through cycles with that sort of stuff whenever it comes to self-help and, you know, going through phases of learning and doing. And I think the same is true for people who are working for themselves. Like they're, and really just anything, any aspect of your life, you go through these areas where you kind of have to research and gather information, and then you have to go out and do. So like right now you're really nerding out on gear and figuring out, you know, all the information that you need to have in order to successfully hike this trail. But that's not enough. Like at some point, you're just going to have to go out and do and learn for yourself, right? And you're going to have experiences that nobody has could ever prepare you for. And that's like the cool thing about being a human in this world.
Yeah,
I think for me, whenever it comes to like self-help, but especially more on the spiritual side of things, for me, there have been things that I've always had feelings about, but I haven't had language or even that kind of oh, I'm not alone in this, like those kind of Me Too experiences. And the more I'm digging into it, the more I'm realizing it is really, truly a personal experience, and that we're all going to perceive spirituality or even religion in different ways. So I just think it's so fascinating, the idea of spirituality, but then like how spirituality forms together to create religions, and then how that ends up, you know, for better or worse. For me, like my view on it is for worse. Like I don't feel like much good comes out of like the organized religion aspect, like on a large scale. I think on a small scale, getting together with a group of people who are like-minded where you can like really ask questions is a good thing. But for me, I think for me, what spirituality has really become is acknowledging that I like living in a world where there are mysteries and where I can try and live in that mystery and align myself with that mystery. Like that's where I'm at with spirituality right now.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful. I don't know where I'm at with it. I mean, I think where I'm at with it is this is the like kind of the belief that there is something that's larger than me, right? Whatever name you want to put to that, is the only thing that helps break me out of that like control freak place. Like that if, you know, when people talk about that, the antidote to that is surrender, that only makes sense to me if you're surrendering to something else, because otherwise to me, it just feels like giving up. And
yes, I love that you say that, because that's how I feel about surrender too. Or that sometimes like I picture surrender as having to like cut off my arm or give myself a lobotomy. Like that's what surrender would look like for me if I didn't believe in a higher power.
Yeah, exactly. That like there has to be like that. I find that to be very comforting, even just like the mental picture of surrender, right? Just like, okay, here you go, God, or, you know, whatever words people want to use. Like, okay, I can't do this on my own. Like I die. Okay. And even that, like just whether there is some like miraculous event that happens next or not, like it's not really about a results oriented thing for me. It's just about giving myself permission to believe that I am not in charge of everything. Cause that is like a very stressful, depression inducing place for me. And, you know, I think, you know, obviously we just like touched on the self-help stuff. I think that's an easy one to kind of go black and white, that it's like, well, I'm either going to be super into this or I'm going to give up and like then not grow at all. Right. Which is obviously not what either one of us are saying, but it's, for me, it's oftentimes like looking at the intention or the motivation behind it. Like the self-help that tends to be self-destructive for me is if I'm doing it for like a fear of missing out, like everyone's reading this book about whatever, so I'm never going to be happy, healthy, loved, the right body shape, you know, whatever, you know, rich, sexy, whatever. If I don't read this thing, or if I don't do this thing, or if I don't meditate, or if I don't whatever, I don't drink green juice, or if I don't, you know, have my own business, or, you know, anything that you want to put there, that tends to wind up being self-destructive for me. Like if I'm doing it for those, like a fear-based reason, like if I'm trying to grow from a place of fear, it's not going to work. If I am turning to kind of an expert or like an external source to try to soothe like just a normal human sense of confusion or loneliness, or that, okay, well, the solution to like being lonely is to figure out, you know, these five ways to do, you know, whatever, just like sit there and be lonely. Right. So it's like when I'm reaching for self-help for the same reasons that I would have in the past reached for alcohol, like ding, 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 don't do that. You know?
Right. Yeah, that's such a good point. And I think that for me, whenever I'm reaching, I mean, to anything, but especially self-help and books on spirituality or even courses on it, for me, it has to come from a deep place of curiosity and interest. Like, I just can't not learn more about this thing. Mm-hmm. Because if it is from a fear-based place, I don't know, for me, I just get bored with it.
Yeah.
And then I also really tend to trust teachers or mentors or, you know, whoever it might be, who are living in the question just as much as anybody else. And that comes to business, that comes to spirituality, that comes to relationships. It's kind of that addressing the common humanity. I'm incredibly skeptical of gurus, like even Jesus Christ himself. Like whenever he says stuff like follow me or praise me, like I'm God, I'm like, how did he really know? And no offense to any of your Christian listeners, and I don't even know like what your faith is around that, but Christianity being the primary religion in the United States, you know, even that, I'm just like, really? Like, how did you know? And what if someone were saying that today? What would that look like? What would the response be? So I tend to trust people who are also really living in the question. And I'll throw a few out there just to mention it. It's like, one is Byron Katie. I really enjoy her work. Another is Brené Brown, who does not want to be considered a spiritual leader, but I think that the stuff that she is talking about and exploring in her work is so spot on. So, you know, people who are just kind of living in the question too and exploring it and writing about it.
Yeah, I mean, and what I'm getting out of what you're saying, or what I think you're speaking to that's really resonating with me, is just kind of the permission to choose your own teachers or mentors, or that it's mm-hmm. okay to, and to have it, it doesn't have to be, these are the texts that go with this doctrine, right? Because I would agree with you that I don't think people would look at Brené Brown and think spiritual teacher, but I agree that there's a lot of really beneficial spiritual principles that I think that I have gotten from her work, right? So it's like, it's for me kind of this spiritual journey, there's that little phrase again, is about kind of being open to truth in whatever the form that it comes in. And again, not judging, well, this isn't where I'm supposed to be getting my spiritual lesson, right? Or like, again, not trying to control it. Spiritual lesson has to come from church. Is church a great place? Sure, right? But like, it doesn't, it's for me trying to be open to that. And I find a lot of that in nature, right? That's like Sunday morning, church of nature, you know, whatever.
Yes.
So it's being open for me. Like I need to be open to, you know, whatever feels true. And like you said, curiosity. I think there's a lot of good that comes from following our curiosity, whatever that is, right? Whatever that's about. And you know, that I like what you said about gravitating towards and trusting people who are living in the questions. For me, that's relevant. But the other thing that's also really relevant is people, especially if they are, you know, more thought of as spiritual teachers, if they're very clearly speaking in that space, is the ability to bring it into kind of the real messy like truth of what it is to like be a human in the world, right? Because like I can sit here and say, you know, these are my principles, right? Like that I always believe in being kind or being whatever. But like it's really easy to have your principles like until those principles become inconvenient for you, right? Like until someone is an asshole, right? Or until, I don't know, I mean, I'm sure we could come up with 1,000 examples, right? That it's really easy to say like, this is what I believe, this is who I am, this is how I behave, until that becomes inconvenient. And I need I need it to be spoken about in that way, right? That, you know, it's fine to have a spiritual principle that revolves around like not being envious or not, you know, any of those. Okay, well, but until like I see something on Instagram and I'm like, fuck, I'm so jealous.
Right.
So I need it spoken to me also in that way. Like there has to be a fundamental like underlying thing of that it's like messy and hard and beautiful and wonderful and ridiculous and hilarious and painful to like be a human in the world. And,
yeah.
You know?
And I think it's that acknowledging, like, here's what this looks like in reality. And so, like, okay, for example, I really love kind of the more mystical, probably almost even new age modalities of spirituality. And, but, like, one thing I cannot hang with is, like, I don't even know how to say this, but I can only describe it as, like the idea of maybe women sitting in a circle in really soft voices talking about their yonis, you know, like, do you see what, like, can you picture that?
Yes,
like,
I can picture that. I know what you mean.
Like,
yeah.
There's something about that doesn't even feel real in the world. Now, granted, that might totally be their truth and I'm not knocking that at all. And that might be like their expression, but I need to be able to see models of spirituality, you know, because I like to, I really do rely on people like modeling for me ways of being and then taking bits and pieces of that and seeing how it applies to my life. I don't even know where I was going with that. But one thing that I was thinking about whenever you're talking about like having your principles, my husband is actually an atheist. And so we have a lot of conversations and he knows how I am and I know how he is.
But he was really talking, we were having a good conversation last night about like what we want to be known for or what we aspire to be. And one of the things that he was saying is that he aspires to be and wants to be known for being someone with principles, like being just a principled man. And I just bring that up because I think you don't have to subscribe to any sort of spirituality or even recognize a higher power to still be a really good, morally driven person.
Right, to be living what would to someone else look like a spiritually driven life. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And another thing I want to mention here, only because I think one of my biggest fears is being misunderstood, is I totally believe in science. And whenever one of my favorite shows is Cosmos with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Have you ever watched any of that?
Yes, I have. Mm-hmm.
So good. And whenever I watch Neil deGrasse Tyson talk about space and get tears in his eyes because it's so moving for him, for me, that is a spiritual experience. And it feels, I don't know, like that's what I want spirituality in the world to be, is like personally driven. For Neil deGrasse Tyson, it might be space. For someone else, it might be Jesus Christ. For someone else, it might be a flower growing out of a crack in some concrete.
Yeah. I mean, one, I think that also in the kind of last thing I'll say to even tie this back to what we were talking about at the beginning with branding in a way that doesn't give you flexibility to change, right? Like we have, because we want to belong, whatever, you know, to something, that I think that we, or at least I, have a tendency to like very quickly want to over-identify, right? Like I'm a runner, I'm a vegan, I'm this, because then all of a sudden you get to belong to what that is. And I think the same can be true with spiritual groups and stuff as well. And while it feels lovely to belong, and like you said, to be in community in like actual real life with people who, you know, believe what you believe or have questions about the things that you have questions about, that it's so wonderful. But sometimes I feel like I can lose like the real truth of the matter by getting stuck on the surface level of trying to like pick a box to belong to, right? That like I find a lot of truth and wisdom in a lot of Buddhist teachings and readings that I've been doing. Like, you know, if we're naming people, I know you mentioned Byron Katie, Brene Brown, like Pema Chodron is definitely that for me. And so then I went down the thing of, okay, well, like obviously I should start practicing Tibetan Buddhism. And I was like, just shush, like you're like you can get so much from this, and this doesn't have to be right. Because then I was upset that then I read something else, you know, that really, really super resonated with me. I read, have you read the book Accidental Saints?
Is that with
it's Nadia Bowles Weber? Yeah.
Yes.
So phenomenal, right? That this, you know, she's like a Lutheran pastor that basically describes herself as the least likely person, you know, former alcoholic, drug addict, covered in tattoos, like right. Was not likely to do this. And the tagline, so it's called Accidental Saints, and the tagline is finding God in all the wrong people. And like, it's obviously a very Christian text, and I had never read something that resonated with me like from that space. And I read that book and I was like, oh my God, like now I need to be a Lutheran. And so again, I'm like, just right. Relax, right? That there's anything wrong with being Lutheran or Buddhist or any of these things, but like I see in myself that desire to just, again, pick something and be done with it, right? Like this is going to be my thing now. And so trying to slow that down and allow, you know, truth from where it comes from has just been like a really nice process for me.
Yeah, there's some, you know, I just wrote a newsletter about identity and labels and how labels can really empower us. So for me, for example, growing up in an advertising agency world, or growing up in my career rather, I felt like I couldn't write. Like I was not a copywriter. Meanwhile, I'm blogging every day, but I'm still like, I'm not a writer. And then there was something really powerful the day that I was like, you know what? I actually am a writer. Like just because I'm not a copywriter doesn't mean that I'm not a writer. And then being able to identify myself as a writer really liberated me into being able to write about things that felt a little trickier or a little more complicated. So it really empowered me labeling myself as a writer. But then these labels can kind of start to hurt us, or even identity markers like having long blonde dreads or the label of blogger, or even one that for me is like creative entrepreneur, like being in that label, I'm like, I don't even know what that means anymore. or the label of authenticity, and kind of going back to my list of questions, like, what does that actually mean? And so I think that identity and labels, they can empower us, they can give us power, but they can also at some point strip us of our power. And I think that you saw that even happen whenever you're like, I'm a runner, this is what I do, I do this every day, and then kind of just taking it for granted and not questioning it until you're in the middle of the woods having a breakdown, right?
Right, totally. Oh my God, Kathleen, I want to talk to you for 100 hours. I think that we could do that. But in service of your time and everyone else's time, the way that I love to wrap these up, which listeners are, if this is not your first time to the show, you are familiar with, are with what we call community questions. So they're questions that Real Talk Radio listeners have asked to hear about from each guest of a current season. So for this season, we have 9 kind of rapid fiery mix of questions for you to answer.
Perfect.
Okay. So the first one, what is your current guilty pleasure?
So I typically don't feel guilty for my pleasures, but my current guilty pleasure, I feel like this is such a cliche guilty pleasure. Anyway, I just watched the last season of The Kardashians on Hulu and I loved it, but I'm not guilty.
Yeah. I mean, and so it's funny, that's sometimes I will put kind of a disclaimer before that question of, I don't believe that we need to feel guilty for pleasure, but because this is a phrase that people understand. But I think the thing about a guilty pleasure is, like, when I define guilty pleasure, it's something that even like as I'm doing it and loving it, that I'm kind of like, or like that it's not, there's no like worthwhile thing attached, right? That it's for me, like watching Gossip Girl, right? Like there's nothing wrong with that, but like it's a little bit of a guilty pleasure because I want it in like very specific circumstances, right? It's like the junk food of,
you know, exactly. You know, it's like I almost said, like, it's not the thing I'm going to be writing about, but watch, next week I'm going to write about the lesson I learned from the Kardashians. Right. So that's my search for meaning and everything. Okay. Right.
The next question, what's something that you do to inspire or encourage yourself when you're feeling defeated?
Can I do 2 things?
Yes.
Okay. Like the more respectable answer would probably be reading something. You know, anytime I can read something, it always gets my gears turning and it always inspires me. But number 2, and the thing that I don't think enough people are saying, is like, have an orgasm. Like, that's going to get you out of your funk. Like, just get it on with yourself, get it on with someone else, have an orgasm.
I love that. I mean, and what I was going to say, which is not the same as this, but it speaks to that, like, state change or phase change. Like, I find if I like put on an amazing song that I love and like have a dance party in my underwear, like in the middle of the living room, like just something that like physically changes, like shakes things up, right? Which obviously an orgasm would do. So yes.
Totally.
What's something that you really love about yourself?
I love so much about myself. I can't pick just one. I would say that I love I tend to think of myself as pretty disciplined, especially around fitness. And I love that. Like, I love that even on days where I don't necessarily want to work out, I'm willing to put on my shoes and go out the door.
Yeah, I love that. Who are 2 or 3 of your favorite people to follow on social media?
On social media. So Sarah Von Bargen. And she's a mutual friend of ours. And one thing that I love about her is that I feel like she hasn't really boxed herself in on like having this very specific personal brand or focus. And she's just writing about really interesting things. And her series on her blog called True Stories, I think, is really fascinating. Someone else I love following on social media. Can I use like hashtags?
Of course, you can do whatever you want.
So I love Instagram. And like some hashtags that I love looking at are, or maybe not even hashtags, but like certain categories. I love following certain tattoo artists. Okay, I have someone specific. Let me find her real quick. I think her name is Alice Rules on Instagram. Anyway, there's this like group of tattoo artists out of Portland, Oregon. And I just love looking at their tattoos. They want me to like, or they inspire me to want to get a full sleeve of beautiful floral botanical tattoos. I also really love, I've become obsessed with YouTube and watching YouTube makeup tutorials. And so one of my favorite people to watch on YouTube is Jeffree Star. he does, I mean, he's just like doing makeup that I would never do on myself, but I just love watching his videos. He's one of those people that just owns it. So I love following him.
That's awesome. And so this is one of my favorite questions because then I get new people to check out and follow myself. So it's fun. What's a time that you quit something and it was absolutely the right decision?
I was married once before my current husband and I quit that marriage and I think that was a really solid decision. And I want to clarify though that like nothing was wrong. It's not like he was beating me or that we didn't get along. So that's one of those things where it like felt like a really not hard decision, but like kind of like everything is right on paper. What's wrong with me?
Yes.
But, you know, like kind of going with my gut there and quitting that marriage was definitely a good decision.
I mean, I'm going to really hold myself back from turning this into like a whole another 30 minutes of conversation, which obviously we could do a part two. But I think that it's relatively easy to walk away from a terrible situation, whether that's like a job or a relationship or whatever. Like if it's awful, it's a lot easier to leave. It's a lot harder to walk away from something that's good, but not great. Or that's a yes, but not a true yes. And I mean, I had a relationship, it wasn't a marriage, but same thing. Like, we loved each other, but we weren't in love. And it was good, but it wasn't great. And I spent a year in like indecision of same thing. What's wrong with you that you can't just be happy with this? What kind of grass is greener situation do you think? Like there was a lot of really negative self-talks. Like I very much acknowledge and honor what you're saying, that it's very difficult to quit something that like without letting it get to the like rock bottom point.
Yeah.
I love that.
It's almost like what you were talking. Sorry, we're gonna turn this 30 minutes, but it's kind of what you were talking about with having a child and kind of deciding not to have a child. I don't know, and even being an addict and being an alcoholic. Like obviously, you can look at it was really good to quit alcohol, but that's kind of obvious, right? Like yeah. I've never been an addict. So like, obviously like whenever you're in that moment, although I do have like, and I'm seeing a lot of similarities, like addictive personality where I want to go like 100% into anything that I'm doing. But, it's hard to quit things that don't seem like obvious bad choices.
Yeah. Well, and I did a special bonus episode of my podcast that I released on May 1st, kind of in between the seasons, that was all about my friend Julia. She interviewed me basically about my history with drinking and all this kind of stuff. And like one of the key things that I shared was one of the hardest things about quitting was that it wasn't that bad, quote, that bad, right? Like, it's not like I woke up in a gutter and didn't remember where I was, like that, but that doesn't mean that it wasn't a problem, right? So it's like being able to validate the seriousness of whatever's going on, even if other people have it worse, right? That like your problems are still your problems, even though like people in the world don't have clean water.
Do you follow Melissa Hartwig? She wrote and designed the Whole 30. Like if you've heard of any of that paleo stuff, you should follow her. She used to be an addict and then she kind of discovered like the whole 30 paleo CrossFit lifestyle. And one of the things that she talked about is exactly the same where like it wasn't really bad. She was like, I'm not a heroin addict, even though I've been doing heroin. but she was like, she's gone through phases where she either wanted to be the best addict and like really rock bottom, like the worst person, or she goes through phases where she's like, it wasn't that bad. So it's just kind of like also interesting, like how do you draw that line between rock bottom and kind of bad? And
well, it goes back to what we were saying about labels, right? That sometimes they're empowering and sometimes they're not, because sometimes we feel, I felt this way before, like I got help for depression for such a long time because I'm not in the hospital after a failed suicide attempt, so probably I'm fine. Like I have this tendency to really downplay anything that's not the most extreme story that I've ever heard publicized, right? That like, and that's not a great behavioral pattern, you know? So I mean, obviously there's a lot that we could do. Anyway, putting the muzzle on myself. Next, what was your very first job, the first thing that someone paid you to do?
My very first job. Well, I don't know how far back I can go. I learned how to juggle whenever I was 7 years old, and I was performing at the medieval fair juggling, and someone like put a dollar in my cup. That's like the first thing I can really remember getting paid to do that was like really fun. My first job in high school was working at JCPenney as like a sales clerk.
I mean, that juggling answer is the best answer I've heard. That's okay, amazing. Cool. I love that. We're going to go with that.
Let's stick with that.
That was your original job. You were a juggler.
Yeah.
At a medieval fair. That's amazing.
And the funny thing about that is I taught my brother how to juggle, and now he's a sideshow performer, like legit for a living. He swallows swords and breathes fire and does that for
a living.
See,
you never know where something's going to lead.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
What's one habit that you'd love to build in your daily life?
Okay, so going back to like working out, I feel like I'm actually really good at building habits into my life. So I'm going to switch this question into what habit would I like to kick, which is I've recently fallen back into biting my nails.
I'm the worst nail biter. My husband and I are too. And every day we're like, nope, no biting, no biting, no biting. And so now we've gotten pretty close to buying whatever that gross stuff is that you put on your nails that tastes terrible.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
And like for someone to tell me to not bite my nails, like I get like a physical urge to punch them in the throat whenever someone tells me to not bite my nails. But I dropped the habit for a good, 4 years, and I just fell back into it, and I haven't been able to kick it.
Yeah.
So I think I might go get a manicure or something. That usually helps.
Yeah, that does help. I agree. Yeah. So
nails
funny.
Are so wrecked right now, though, that like I would be embarrassed to get a manicure, but I need to just go do it.
Right. So that's your action step here.
Yeah.
What are two or three books that have had a really big impact on you?
Okay, one, Daring Greatly by Brené Brown has changed my life. Like, that book was a game changer. Two is Rework by Jason Fried and David Heinemeier Hansen. It is my business Bible.
Yeah, like, I love that book.
We were talking earlier about, like, all these e-courses and wanting to have the formula. Their book is so concise, and what I love about it is that there's no formula. There's no, like, follow these steps and you'll have the best launch ever. It's just, like, really philosophical, amazing, bite-sized pieces of, oh, yeah, duh. But if you follow them and you create action steps in what they're teaching into your business, man, it's my business Bible. I love that book. A third book, let me think of something else I've written or I've read that has changed my life. Here's one. The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz.
Mm-hmm.
There's a specific, so the Four Agreements are don't take anything personal, be impeccable with your word, don't make assumptions, and always do your best. But the one that really changed my life was don't take anything personal. So check out the Four Agreements and just read that chapter and you'll be good. Or, you know, whichever chapter speaks to you.
Oh my God. You and I, well, once we get off this, we're destined to be really good friends because this is, no pressure. This is the first time that someone answering that question that I've read every single one of those books and wholeheartedly agree in how fabulous they are. So yes, I agree with you.
Yay.
The last question, when you look ahead at the next few months, what do you feel most excited about?
Okay, so my family always goes on a big beach vacation together in June, and it's really cheesy. We go to a place called Seaside, Florida, which is pretty much the whitest place I've ever been. I really like taking adventures where you're experiencing different cultures and maybe struggling a little bit and having to learn something about yourself, but Seaside is just so easy, and my whole family gets together, so my brother always comes in from wherever he's living at the time, and my sister and her kids, and me and my husband, and now our child Fox, and my parents, like everyone just gets together and has a really good time for a week, or even not even a good time, but just a chill time. I'm also visiting my best friend Liz in Michigan. She has a cabin up there right on Lake Superior, and she's my best friend. We live 1,000 miles apart, and so I can't wait to see her again. So those are probably like travel related things or things that I'm really looking forward to in the next few months.
That's super exciting. So for anyone who is listening, what's the best place for them to find you online and what's kind of your favorite way to connect with new people?
Yeah. So Being Boss is my podcast and we had you on our show, which thanks for coming on there. And so you can find that website at beingboss.club. And we write articles there as well. Or you can find us on iTunes at Being Boss. Where else am I? I'm at braidcreative.com. So that's kind of my, I put it in quotes, day job, even though I'm the owner of that. And then also online, like on a more personal level, Instagram, my name is at Ann Kathleen. That's probably the best way to find me and to kind of follow along with my daily life. I'm also on Periscope at Ann Kathleen. I like to hop on there and jam out every once in a while.
And I will put links to all of that stuff in the show notes. Also, last thing, did I see correctly that your podcast just hit 1 million downloads?
Yes.
That's huge, girl. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Yeah. So everyone definitely check out the show, especially if you want to dig into more of the kind of creative entrepreneurial stuff that we have been talking about, because your show is great and that's a huge milestone. So that's super exciting. Ah, thank you so much. This has been such a wonderful example of real talk, right? Like, I feel like we went there on so many topics, and it was great to have you on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening and for being such a truly important member of the Real Talk Radio family. I couldn't and wouldn't do this without you. And as I said way back at the top of the episode, this is now a 100% listener-supported show, meaning that from season 5 onward through the end of 2016, I'm experimenting with an ad-free, sponsor-free podcast. To support the show and help make this possible, and to get access to incredible bonus content every other month, go to patreon.com/NicoleAntoinette to make your pledge of $8 or more for each 8-episode season. I can't tell you how much your support means to me, and I can't wait to get to know you better behind the scenes in our little community. So until next time, here's a big virtual hug and a reminder that we're all just doing the best we can, and that no matter what, we're in this together.